Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the First Chronicles chapter 20. And this First Chronicles, and then you read the same different accounts that are set forth in Second Samuel, there are some discrepancies. I dealt with some of them last week, and there are some ones that we're going to be dealing with tonight. And I do think there's some logical explanations, even though, like I said, people can very often just attack the Bible, saying, well, it's full of contradictions, it's undependable, you can't rely upon it. And there are some, I think, in my opinion, some very legitimate concerns. But I do think that most of them can be explained away one way, shape, or form or another. And I'll show you what I mean. Beginning of this chapter 20 of 1 Chronicles, it says, then it happened in the spring at the time when the kings go out to battle that Joab led out the army and ravaged the land of the sons of Ammon and came and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem and Joab struck Rabbah and overthrew it. Now, this account that is listed here in 1 Chronicles, interesting thing. That when you read it in Samuel, we read about an episode there that's completely omitted in 1 Chronicles. Mm-hmm. Anybody know what that episode is? Mm-hmm. Well, if you read in it's in 2 Samuel chapter 11 through 12, this is what it says. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. Now, Rabbah was the capital of...
That was Bathsheba's husband.
Yes. Okay. Well, it says the sons of Ammon besieged Rabbah. Rabbah, if you can see it up there, I underlined it, are basically, highlighted in red off there to the right. That was the capital of the Ammonites. And... they went to war, but interesting thing, it says, but David stayed at Jerusalem during this time. And in Chronicles, it completely omits this story, and totally. And it says, now when the evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived and sent and told David and said, I am pregnant. And of course, we know that story, that when he found that out, then he sent for her husband, Uriah, who's out there fighting the sons of Ammon. He comes back, and David figures, well, what I'll do is I'll just, pretend I'm going to just basically find out how the war's going and how their strategies are working out and what's going on with the battle and so on and so forth. So he had him for dinner, and then, afterwards, David just assumed, well, now he's going to go home and sleep with his wife, and then when he finds out she's pregnant, he won't know the difference. But Uriah the Hittite doesn't go home. He just didn't feel right about that, feeling like, all my buddies are out there sleeping on the cold ground in this war, and he didn't feel comfortable with going home and, making love to his wife and having all those comforts. So apparently he just spent the night in the barracks or, with the service. And so when David found that out, he thought, well, why don't you go home? He said, well, I just don't feel right about that. So then David gets him drunk the next night, thinking, well, I'll just lower his inhibitions and then he'll go home and sleep with his wife, and that'll be the end of that. Well, Uriah doesn't go home. And then David figures, well, that's not working. So we all know the story. Then he writes a letter to Joab, the commander, and says, hey, man, have Uriah put out on the front lines on a suicide mission to make sure that he's killed. Now, can you believe it? This is David. This is a man after God's own heart. This is a guy who loved God with all his heart, mind, soul, and strength. But look at the depth that he is falling now. And, of course, we know the situation that God sent a prophet to him and just rebuked him to his face and said, because you've done this, the sword will never depart from your house. And God just judged him severely. But interesting thing, we're reading this First Chronicles, and it doesn't make one mention of that. Not one mention. I'm going to read this verse one again in First Chronicles chapter 20. It says, then it happened in the spring, at the time when the kings go out to battle, that Joab led out the army and ravaged the land of the sons of Ammon and came and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem and Joab struck Rabbah and overthrew it. That's all it says. David stayed at Jerusalem. Now, I think there's a dark warning in there. Just the fact that David, he was always out in the front, always leading his men, always out, basically, you know, leading the charge in terms of all the battles. But now I think he's getting a little too comfortable. Now he's got his palace. Now he's, you know, enjoying the good life. And the interesting thing to me, that when we read that account over there in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12, we read that it says that David got up in the evening. What's the suggestion there?
Slept in all day? I don't know.
You know, the guy, you know, when he should be going to bed, you know, instead he's waking up. So there's something, I don't know, just suggested there that the guy isn't where he should be, and apparently he's really getting laxed in a lot of ways, and now the devil just hits him from a blind side. And I think that that's a solemn warning to any person who's living for God. I don't care how many years of service we have, you know, serving the Lord, or how successful we may have been in the past. I mean, the devil is always looking for an opportunity to bring us down, right? And I think the seed of his destruction was basically planted in the fact that, you know what, you should have been out there, instead you're over here. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of times Christians are brought down by the devil because instead of going to church, they're doing something else. Instead of going to Bible study, they're doing something else. Instead of reading the Bible, they're doing something else. Instead of having their quiet time, they're doing something else. See, you get into a situation where you become lax. And then I'll tell you, man, the devil can take you down in a heartbeat. And that's what happened to David there. And I think that's a dark warning. But then in verse 2 of chapter 20 of 1 Chronicles, it says, excuse me, David took the crown of their king from his head, and he found it to weigh a talent of gold, and there was a precious stone in it, and it was placed on David's head, and he brought it out, the spoils of the city, very great in amount. He brought out the people who were in it, and cut them with saws, and with sharp instruments, and with axes, and thus David did to all the cities of the sons of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. Now, in this account here, look what it says here. Now, verse 3, he brought out the people who were in it and cut them with saws and with sharp instruments and with axes. Now, you read that and it sounds like he was just mutilating people to no end. But then, if you read the account in 2 Samuel chapter 12, this is what it says. Verse 26, it says, now Joab fought against Rabbah of the sons of Ammon and captured the royal city. Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah. I have even captured the city of waters. Now therefore gather the rest of the people together and camp against the city and capture it, or I will capture the city myself and it will be named after me. So David gathered all the people and went to Rabbah, fought against it, and captured it. Then he took the crown of their king from his head, and its weight was a talent of gold, and in it was a precious stone, and it was placed on David's head. And he brought out the spoils of the city in great amounts. And he also brought out the people who were in it, and set them under saws, sharp iron instruments, and iron axes, and made them pass through the brick kiln. And thus he did to all the cities of the sons of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So when he says he set them under, so what's the suggestion now? You got to take these two counts together, because over here in Chronicles it says, and cut them with saws. But he said he set them under saws.
He made them slaves.
Yes.
To work for.
Yes.
That's what mine says. It set them to labor.
Right. So, like I'm saying, sometimes these accounts in Samuel and in Chronicles, they could be pretty darn confusing, but you got to take it together and kind of figure it out that what he really did was he put these people under hard labor. Now, just remember who Ammon was. He was basically the result of an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughters. And interesting thing, too, in Deuteronomy chapter 23, it says this, no one who is emasculated or has a male organ cut off shall enter the assembly of the Lord. No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord, because they did not meet you with food and water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethros Mesopotamia to curse you. Now, interesting thing. God said this, no Ammonite, no Moabites to enter the assembly of the Lord, even though these people were actually related to God's people and they could lay claim to the God of heaven. How?
Through Lot, I guess.
Through Lot, who was the nephew of Abraham. Paul tells us very clearly in Galatians chapter 3 that all of this law that God set forth is our tutor. It's our teacher. So we always got to ask, okay, what is our teacher trying to tell us? All right? And when it's talking about here, nobody who is emasculated can enter the assembly of the Lord, what's our teacher really saying? We always got to take it to the spiritual level, because God uses the physical world to teach us spiritual principles. The physical law is no longer intact. That's what Paul says. All it was a tutor. All it was a teacher to lead us to Christ. All right, but this principle is still intact. What's the principle when God says, I don't want anybody in assembly who is emasculated or who has crushed testicles or torn or cut testicles? What's the principle?
Are we to be perfect and holy? No.
Be able to reproduce.
There it is. Yeah. There it is. And same thing, God said the same thing in Leviticus, I think chapter 21, when he's dealing with priests. He said, nobody can minister to me as a priest if he has crushed testicles, you know, or is emasculated. Well, that doesn't apply today, but the spiritual principle is very much intact, and this is it. God wants his ministers, his pastors, his priests, his evangelists, his teachers, and his people to reproduce themselves spiritually. Paul referred to Timothy as being his son. Well, he wasn't his blood son, but it was his spiritual son. Anyone you may lead to Jesus Christ becomes your spiritual offspring. See, you get what I'm saying? And I read a statistic, and I tell you, it's pretty appalling. And if it's even close to being true, which I kind of suspect it is, it said that 95% of church members never lead another soul to Christ. Now, if that's even close to being true, that's pretty appalling, isn't it? So what God is saying is, I want my people to reproduce themselves, all right? But then he's saying, I don't want any Ammonite or Moabite entering the assembly of the Lord, even up to the 10th generation. Well, what is the 10th generation really saying? What does it really apply to?
By 10 generations, you probably won't know if you're an Ammonite or a Moabite.
Right. Not only that, how far can you go back in your lineage, your genealogy? Your grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, how far can you go back? I bet you can't go back 10 generations. Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay. 7 generations.
You can? Well, that's pretty unusual, even if you can go back that far. But nobody can go back 10. When I say nobody, it's very, very unlikely. All right? We can go back 10 generations. So God is saying this. No Moabite, no Ammonites ever going to see heaven. But you got to take it to the spiritual level. Because most certainly there was a Moabite who came into the assembly of the Lord. Who was that person?
Naomi? Or
Ruth. It was Ruth. Ruth was a Moabite. She forsook her gods, came into the assembly of the Lord, became the great-grandmother of David. So, she was a Moabite, but she's in a Jesus Christ genealogy, because now she can come into the assembly of the Lord because she forsook her gods, right? And forsook her people. And became part of the assembly, right? But see, we have modern day Ammonites and Moabites in the church today. They're all over the place. Who are they really? Spiritually. They're illegitimate, but they're in the church. In other words, they're not born again.
Jesus
said, truly, truly I say unto you, or amen, I say unto you, unless a man become born again, what? He will never even see the kingdom of heaven. See, that's what this is all dealing with, right? And there's almost perpetual war between the Ammonites and Moabites against God's true people. Even today, you won't find an Ammonite, you won't find a Moabite. They've been wiped off the face of the earth. But spiritually, they're all over the place. They're in the church, and they're always at war with God's people. But God has a judgment for them. But they can, if they get their life turned around and give their life to Christ and become born again, they can see heaven. But I know I've been off, kind of all over the map here, but we're dealing with Ammon. And David is a type of Christ. And he goes over there, and after his army defeats the Ammonites, David gets all the credit. Because Joab told them, hey man, we got this city surrounded, it's ready to fall, you better get over here, otherwise if it's going to fall to me, it's going to be named after me. So David goes over there, and he gets the credit. But take it to where we live and breathe. In this spiritual warfare that we're in, all right, we may do all the, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears on this battleground in terms of wrestling against flesh and blood, and really, as Paul says, fighting the good fight, enduring hardships as a good soldier in Christ Jesus, this type of thing. But who really gets the credit?
Jesus
Christ, for every victory that we ever have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he comes back, we are told in Revelation 19, Revelation is probably my favorite book in the Bible, and then probably my most favorite chapter in the Bible is Revelation 19, when it says, and I saw the heavens open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems. And we were just reading how David has... He gets this crown on his head, right? Because a diadem is a crown, and he has many crowns on many diadems, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself, and he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood. His name is called the Word of God, and the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, are following him on white horses, and from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that wood that he may strike down the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And he says he's going to rule these nations with a rod of iron. And what do we reading over here about David putting all of these people in subjection and servitude under saws and axes and sharp instruments? In other words, he enslaved them, right? Mm. Anyway, in that verse 4, 1 Chronicles chapter 20, it says, now it came about after this that the war broke out in Gezer with the Philistines, and then Shebekiah the Hushite killed Sipai, one of the descendants of the giants, and they were subdued. Mm-hmm. And there was war with the Philistines again, and Elhanah, the son of Jair, killed Lahmi, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. And again, there was war at Gath, and there was a man of great stature who had 24 fingers and toes, 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. And he also was a descendant of the giants. From the giants. When he taunted Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimea, David's brother, killed him. Mm-hmm. These were descendants from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Now, I'm going to go back up to this verse 5. This is what it says. And there was war with the Philistines again, and Elhanah, the son of Jair, killed Lahmi, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Now, you know what it says in 2 Chronicles chapter 21? It says this. Now, it came about after this that there was war again with the Philistines at Gob. Then Shebekiah, the Hushathite, struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. There was war with the Philistines again at Gob. And Elhanah, the son of Jehoiakim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Now, what's the contradiction?
One was the brother of Goliath,
and the other was Goliath.
Yeah. Yes, but in Samuel it says that Elhanah, the son of Jehoiakim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite. Well, we know that that's not the case, because we obviously know from 1 Samuel chapter 17 it was David that killed him. Yeah. But we are given more information over here in Chronicles that it was Goliath's brother. Now, why it is written that he killed Goliath here in 2 Samuel, I don't believe that that's just a flat-out contradiction. All right, the people who put this together obviously knew that David killed Goliath. But here it said that... Elhanah killed him. And all I can say is this. If you put the two accounts together, I think there is a logical explanation, because how many times have you heard in your own life, well, he's just like his brother. Well, he's a chip off the old block. Well, in other words, I get the impression that this brother of Goliath was of the same size, the same stature, the exact same. It was the exact same as if David did kill Goliath, all right?
And also, John, there is, in any culture, big events that stand out in people's minds. They may have had Goliath as just a figure of speech.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. Because that's exactly, I think, what's happening here. Mm. Now, I'm not trying to torture this, all right? I'm not trying to make apologies for what's said here. But I do believe that in both accounts, the writer, which I believe in Chronicles, was Ezra, knew darn well it was David. So why would there be this discrepancy? Well, all I can say is that, you know, people back then realized exactly what they were saying. Unless there was a word that was left out, that's always a possibility. And if so, then it's kind of a typo. But it doesn't, I think, negate the divine inspiration of this at all, because everybody knows exactly who killed Goliath. But he had a brother that was killed by this Elhanan. Right, now I just say that in passing because, you know, this is what we're dealing with. Now, but now he's talking about these giants. Anybody remember how tall Goliath was?
Over 9 feet.
Yeah, it was 9 foot in a span, so it was like 9'3". And, you know, I've done a lot of research as far as some of the people who lived in our modern day age. And a lot of this has been documented. There was a guy in Russia. He was 9'3", but he died in 1912. There was a guy in England. He grew to 9'3". His name was John Middleton. And he died, way back in the 1600s. I think they got that off of his grave and off of his tombstone. There was a guy here. Now, I don't know how true this is because it's not known. It says that there was a guy in France. The height estimated based upon bone fragments found in a Neolithic cemetery somewhere in France. It was excavated in 1890. They said that he reached 11'6". Now, that's probably not true. That's probably not true. My only point is this. We read about this in Genesis 6 where there's the Nephilim. And matter of fact, the names that people gave to these people of great size, they were the Anak. They were the sons of Anak. They were the sons of Anakim. They were known as the Nephilim. They were also known as the Rephaim. And my point is this. There were people of great size, but they weren't a jolly green giant. But they were people of great size, all right? And they were referred to as giants, all right? Now, they were extremely intimidating, but what are the giants that we have to deal with today? First and foremost, I would say Satan and the powers of darkness. They are extremely intimidating. The one giant here, he's such a mutant. He's got 24 fingers and toes. He's got, you know, I worked with a guy many years ago. He had two thumbs. This guy here, if he's got, you know, six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, I mean, that's kind of a mutation. And quite frankly, that guy who had the two thumbs, that thumb's just getting in your way. That's not an improvement, all right? Believe me, people in evolution like to say, well, you know, evolution came across from jumping from one species to another because of some mutation. Well, every form of mutation is basically a detriment. It's not an improvement, all right? But my point is this. A guy of great size with 12 fingers and 12 toes, he may look pretty darn intimidating, don't you think? Don't you think? Well, we have all kinds of giants that we have to contend with, and a giant by any other name is still a giant. I don't care if they're called Rephaim or Nephilim or they call the Anak or the sons of Anak. We all got our giants we got to deal with, right? And the first on the list is Satan, and then God knows what else we have to deal with. But God is always going to give his people the victory regardless of who we're up against if we just put our faith and our trust in him. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that? That chapter 20.
I would think the having the six fingers would be a benefit in battle because you could say to your enemy, how many fingers am I holding? And just throw them into confusion while they're trying to count and recount.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then hit him right between the head with a sledgehammer. Okay. Okay, I wanted to just quickly go through this chapter 21, and I really want to kind of go back and forth in terms of you know, what is written in 2 Samuel in regards to this particular census, because there are some discrepancies, but I really do think that they could be explained too. But it says here in verse 1 of chapter 21 of 1 Chronicles, it says, "Then Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. So David said to Joab and to the princes of the people, 'Go, number Israel from Beersheba even to Dan, and bring me word that I may know their number.' Joab said, 'May the Lord add to his people 100 times as many as they are. But my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why does my lord seek this thing? Why should he be a cause of guilt to Israel. Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Therefore, Joab departed and went throughout all Israel and came to Jerusalem. And Joab gave the number of the census of all the people to David. And all Israel were 1,100,000 men who drew the sword. And Judah was 470,000 men who drew the sword. But he did not number Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's command was abhorrent to Joab. God was displeased with this thing, so he struck Israel. Now, I think we really do need to look at what it says in 2 Samuel chapter 24, because it says this in 2 Samuel. Now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. Now, I want to read that again, because maybe you didn't catch that. Okay. Now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. Now that's what it says in 2 Samuel chapter 24. And then it says here in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, then Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. Now, the critic of the Bible is going to look at this and say, well, here you go, another gross, flagrant contradiction. The Bible can't be depended upon. It's just a bunch of made-up stuff by a bunch of people. But all I'm saying is this. Take the two accounts together, and what is it telling us?
God used Satan to judge Israel.
Yes, because back there in 2 Samuel chapter 4, it says, now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. In other words, Israel apparently was getting out of God's will. All right, they were probably getting steeped more and more into probably immorality, maybe some idolatry, and whatever it was angering God. So it opened that door up. See, what are we told? I said this many times going through these books, man, that it says in Samuel that rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, all right? And stubbornness is as the sin of idolatry. And my point is this. Apparently, Israel was getting to the point where they were rebelling against God in certain ways. So they opened up that door for Satan to get in and bring them down. But God simply allowed it. Why? Because his anger burned against them. And now, because of that, Satan goes into David and he says, hey, you know what you need to do? Go there and number everybody in Israel. Mm-hmm. And what would be his motive? Because even Joab could see his motive.
Pride.
In other words, look at all the people that I've got under my command. Look at the size of my army. Look at the size of all these people that I'm ruling and reigning over. Mm-hmm. Right? And Joab, in my opinion, was not a godly man. I mean, he believed in the Lord. But, you know, you read about his life and, you know, this guy was a murderer. Mm-hmm. And yet he saw, hey, man, this isn't a good idea. But David absolutely insisted that he do this. Now, see, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood here. We don't wrestle against what we see on the surface here. And Satan can be behind so much of what happens. Look at all the wars that are going on in this world today. I guarantee you that the epic center of every single stink of war is spiritual. It really is, right? And war is a punishment from God. Right? And, you know, there's over 40 wars going on right now throughout the world. And there's more rumors of wars all over the place, isn't there? Just like Jesus Christ predicted. Anyway, David has Joab go out there and do this. And Joab really does not like to do this. But now look at the numbers, because it says in 2 Samuel chapter 24, it says this. So when they had gone about through the whole land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. This is how long it took them to do this census. And it says this, and Joab gave the number of the registration of the people to the king. And there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword. And the men of Judah were 500,000 men. Now, the numbers I'm reading over here in 1 Chronicles, chapter 21, verse 5, it says, Joab gave the number of the census of all the people to David, and all Israel were 1,100,000. Now, 2 Samuel says there was 800,000. So you got a 300,000 man difference there. And then he also said, men who drew the sword, and Judah was 470,000 men who drew the sword. That's in 1 Chronicles, chapter 21, verse 5. But in 2 Samuel, it says there were 500,000. There's a 30,000 men discrepancy there. But I think the key is right here in this verse 6 of 1 Chronicles chapter 21, when it says, "He did not number Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's command was abhorrent to Joab." Because Joab really abhorred this whole thing, it was just an odious stench to him. He cooked the books. That's what it's saying here. That you know, he didn't give the true figures. So I do think that that's an explanation. When it talks about 500,000 men, well, that of Judah, well, very often Benjamin was included in Judah. Well, here, you know, it says he didn't number Benjamin, right? And the Levites. So my point is this. I look at it and I compare the two accounts and I'm saying, yes, the numbers are different, but I think the explanation can be found in this verse 6. Joab, he got the figures, but he didn't give David the true figures. He just felt like, this is disgusting. I'm not going to puff up his pride anymore, right? So he gave a false number. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. It does to me. Anyway, in verse 7 of 1 Chronicles chapter 21, it says this, "But he did not number Levi and Benjamin among them," verse 6, "But he did not number Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's command was abhorrent to Joab. God was displeased with this thing, so he struck Israel. David said to God, 'I have sinned greatly in that I have done this thing, but now please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly.' And the Lord spoke to Gad, David's seer, saying, 'Go and speak to David, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I will do to you.' So Gad came to David and said to him, 'Thus saith the Lord, take for yourself either 3 years of famine, or 3 months to be swept away before your foes, while the sword of your enemies overtakes you, or else 3 days of the sword of the Lord, even pestilence in the land, and the angel of the Lord destroying throughout all the territory of Israel. Now therefore consider what answer I shall return to him to send me.'" Now look at here, because here's another situation where you say, well, now here's another gross flagrant discrepancy, or basically contradiction, but I do think there's a logical explanation to it. And you tell me what it is, because he's saying here, "Thus saith the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I will do to you." So Gad came to David and said to him, "Thus saith the Lord, take for yourself either 3 years of famine, or 3 months to be swept away before your foes, while the sword of your enemies overtakes you, or else 3 days of the sword of the Lord, even pestilence in the land." All right, that's what he said. 3 years of famine, or 3 months being defeated before your enemies, or 3 days of pestilence from the Lord. But then when you read the account in 2 Samuel, verse 11 in chapter 24, 2 Samuel, it says, "When David rose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, 'Go and speak to David. Thus the Lord says, I am offering you three things to choose for yourself, one of them which I will do to you.' So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, 'Shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land?'" Now, what's the big discrepancy?
Seven
years of famine. And over here in Chronicles, it says 3 years of famine. Now, I believe there's a logical explanation to this. How can you reconcile 7 years and 3 years?
Those numbers of God's number, completion, or whatever.
Good. Seven is always used as a number of totality, a number of completeness, a number of perfection, all right? In other words, it's probably just 3 years, but the 7 years of famine means total devastation. Mm-hmm. I believe that what he's referring to here when he uses the number seven is total devastation in regards to the famine. Mm-hmm. 3 years of famine would be the equivalent of total devastation as far as the famine is concerned. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I believe that that is the explanation for this. We have all kinds of expressions. How many times do you have, "I told you a dozen times, don't do that."
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, does that really mean it was a dozen times?
No.
What does a dozen times mean?
A lot.
I like what the one dad says to his kid. "I told you a million times, don't exaggerate." Now, he didn't tell him a million times, did he? But, you see, that's an expression, right? That's why you can find that discrepancy. Anyway, I'm going to wind this down. I left off in this verse 13. David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Please let me fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are very great. But do not let me fall into the hand of man. So the Lord sent a pestilence on Israel. 70,000 men of Israel fell, and God sent an angel to Jerusalem to destroy it. But as he was about to destroy it, the Lord saw and was very sorry over the calamity and said to the destroying angel, "It is enough. Now relax your hand." And the angel of the Lord was standing by the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. Now, the shallow thinker, the fuzzy thinker, you know, he will read this and he will say, "I don't get this at all. What is God, a big bully? 70,000 people lost their lives because David got, you know, this bug in his ear about taking a census. What kind of justice is that?" But put it together. Why were 70,000 people killed?
They were a rebellious nation.
Because they were in rebellion against God. God's anger burned against Israel because they were getting out of his will, and then because of the rebellion, Satan got in there, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a judgment. And then he says here, let me just read that latter part of verse 15 again, because this is very important. When the angel says, "It is enough, now relax your hand." And the angel of the Lord was standing by the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. Then David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between earth and heaven with his drawn sword in his hand, stretched out over Jerusalem. Then David and the elders, covered with sackcloth, fell on their faces. David said to God, "Is it not I who commanded to count the people? Indeed, I am the one who has sinned and done very wickedly. But these sheep, what have they done? O Lord my God, please let your hand be against me and my father's household, but not against your people, that they should be plagued." Now, David, you know, realizes, man, I brought this upon these people. But the full truth of the matter is that this was a judgment for God. All right, these people were not innocent because they got out of God's will and they were acting with rebellion towards him. And at verse 18, then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite. So David went up at the word of Gad, which he spoke in the name of the Lord. Now Ornan turned back and saw the angel and his four sons who were with him hid themselves, and Ornan was threshing wheat. As David came to Ornan, Ornan looked and saw David and went out from the threshing floor and prostrated himself before David with his face to the ground. And David said to Ornan, "Give me the site of this threshing floor that I may build on it an altar to the Lord. So the full price that you shall give it to me, that the plague may be restrained from the people." Ornan said to David, "Take it for yourself and let my lord the king do what is good in his sight. See, I give the oxen for burnt offerings and the threshing sledges for wood and the wheat for the grain offering. I will give it all." But David said to Ornan, "No, but I will surely buy it for the full price, for I will not take what is yours for the Lord or offer a burnt offering which cost me nothing." So David gave Ornan 600 shekels of gold by weight for the site. Then David built an altar to the Lord there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And he called to the Lord, and he answered him with fire from heaven on the altar of burnt offerings. The Lord commanded the angel, and he put his sword back in his sheath. At that time, when David saw the Lord had answered him on a threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, he offered sacrifice there for the tabernacle of the Lord which Moses had made in the wilderness, and the altar of burnt offerings were in the high place at Gibeon at the time. But David could not go before to inquire of God, for he was terrified by the sword of the angel of the Lord. Now, the reason I finished reading that is because, again, there's going to be a discrepancy when we're talking about this threshing floor. And I think there's a logical explanation for it, because in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, it says this: "So Gad came to David that day and said to him, 'Go erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Aruna, the Jebusite.'" Now, Ornan and Aruna are the same person, all right? David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded him. Aruna looked down and saw the king and his servants crossing towards him, and Araunah went out and bowed his face to the ground before the king. And Araunah said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" And David said, "To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be held back from the people." And Araunah said to David, "Let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen are for burnt offerings, and the threshing sledges, and the yokes of oxen for the wood. Everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king." And Araunah said to the king, "May the Lord your God accept you." However, the king said to Araunah, "No, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing." Now listen to this. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Now, it says here that he paid 50 shekels of silver. But then over here, what is it saying? He said 600 shekels of gold weight for the site. Now, put it together, and what is it really saying? Because the critics will take off on this and say the Bible is totally undependable, it's not divinely inspired, it's full of contradiction. But I'm saying, put the two accounts together. What is it saying?
One was for the site and one was for the...
Very good. Now, the site was going to include the entire site where the temple was going to go on. All right, that entire site, David paid 600 shekels of gold for. But you know, when you read what he paid for just the offering, it says this. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. It's making a distinction here between the threshing floor and the site itself. The site itself, it cost him a lot more. But now, this is the site that became what?
The site for the temple.
Yes. Yes, this was the site that God chose. Now, I'm just going to close on this, all right, in case anybody's worried. But God said this specifically in Deuteronomy chapter 12. He said, when you get into your land, all right, you could only offer sacrifice with a place where I choose. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 12, in verses 5 and 6, it says this, "But you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all the tribes to establish his name, there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. There you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes, your contributions of your hand, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flocks. There also you and your household shall eat before the Lord your God, and you rejoice in all your undertakings in which the Lord your God has blessed you." He also says in verse 11, he says this, "Then it shall come about that the place which the Lord your God will choose." I'm going to repeat that again, because this is the place. He says, "Then it shall come about that the place which the Lord your God will choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes, your contributions of your hands," etc. And he goes on to say in 13, "Be careful that you do not offer burnt offerings in every cultic place." And he goes on to simply say, only the places I choose. Only, he says it no less than six times in chapter 12 of Deuteronomy, and is inferred seven different times. Okay? That God is saying, you can only go to this place. Now, this is how God chose that place. Before, they had the tabernacle that was not in Jerusalem at this particular time. Or, excuse me, it was at Gibeon at this particular time. So, this is the place that God chose. And this is how he chose it. See, the devil was out there to try to destroy Israel. God uses it as a chastisement. He uses it as a judgment against his people. But he always turns things around for good. Every single time he will do this, turn it around for good. Because now he chooses the place. And this is the place that they're going to build the temple. And the Jews today, what's on that site today?
Mosque.
It's the Mosque of Omar. It's a holy site to the Muslims. All right. And what's inside that mosque?
A rock.
Black obelisk.
Well, it's a big, huge rock, and they're saying from this rock it's that Abraham apparently offered up Ishmael, all right,
yeah,
on this rock, and that's the rock that they say that Muhammad ascended into heaven from. Whatever, it's a sacred site. Well, you can just see how the devil got that mosque there, right? Mm-hmm. Because the Jews know, well, we can't build our temple any other place because God told us over and over and over and over again in Deuteronomy chapter 12, only the place I choose, only the place I choose, only the place I choose. And that's their historic site. And they know they can't build the temple any other place, right? But you see, you put all this stuff together and you see, hey, man, it really applies even to where we're at today because we haven't heard the end of this site. You know, we have not. Anybody have anyone to add or share to what we read tonight? Mm-hmm.